This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, June 28th. This is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We'll check in with Noah Glasgow of the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Sam Pollock of the Provincetown Independent and Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. CAI's Patrick Flannery speaks to our Statehouse correspondent Katie Lannon, and we'll speak with CAI's Gilda Geist. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. Much of the Cape and islands could be officially designated as seasonal communities in a new state law for housing purposes. The plan is part of a housing bond bill the state Senate passed last night. It still needs to be reconciled with the House bill. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here to tell us more about what that designation could mean. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
So first, which towns would be considered seasonal communities, and what are the criteria here?
Well, first of all, there were some amendments last night to the Senate bill, and I'll mention some of those as they come up. But the language for who is in as a seasonal community on the Cape and Islands is very specific. The Senate bill specifies that Nantucket and all of Dukes County, so Martha's Vineyard plus Gosnold, are designated as seasonal. So is any community in Barnstable County with more than 35% seasonal housing units. That 35 was a change from the 40% before. And they also included in the amendment Berkshire County in Western Mass. Other towns that do not meet those criteria can still be classified as seasonal by the state based on a few different factors. Those are things like, do they have a seasonal increase in population that's really significant? And what is the prevalence of short-term rentals in the town?
What does it mean? What would the benefits be of having this seasonal community designation from the state?
Well, part of the idea is just the creation of this group, kind of like the Gateway Cities designation, so that it forms the basis for the state to do things in the future. But the Senate bill also gives the communities several housing tools to use right away. It allows them to do year-round occupancy restrictions on homes. It allows them to use public money specifically to create housing for town employees, because as we know, some town workers cannot afford to live in our communities. And it also gives towns the right to increase the amount of their tax exemptions on a primary residence. So the point there is that those tax exemptions actually would shift a higher portion of the town's overall tax collection onto non-primary residences. And then the bill also creates an advisory group of seasonal communities to make policy recommendations to the state.
So a lot of potential here. Let's talk about the money. This is a bond bill, so it authorizes borrowing. Is there money here for seasonal communities?
Well, yes and no, because like you said, a bond bill gives the administration permission to borrow money. It does not directly fund anything. But in this bill, it does put a number that is $50 million on the amount that the Healey administration could borrow to pay for grant programs, loans, or other subsidies for housing in seasonal communities, affordable and attainable housing, which is a little bit, you know, slightly higher priced than affordable housing. But again, that is at the discretion of the Healey administration. This is not a budget bill.
We do know that one thing that was left out of this bill in both the Senate and the House was real estate transfer fees. This is fees on high value real estate as it gets bought and sold. This is something that has a lot of support on the Cape and Islands. A number of towns and communities have voted in favor of these. Remind us briefly how they work and what happened that got them dropped from this bill. It really seemed like this was the moment they might get passed through the State House.
Yes, many people did think this could be the moment. This fee or tax, depending on the language you want to use, would be placed on the value of a real estate transaction above a certain amount, generally at least $1 million or the median sale price for the area, whichever is higher. And it would be a local option. Towns would have to approve it individually. Provincetown and the islands really have been big advocates for this as a way to fund local affordable housing initiatives. In terms of why it did not make it into the bill, there's always a lot of trading and negotiating for these big bond bills. It's very hard to get on the record comments about what happened in those negotiations. But we do know that one element, at least, is the real estate industry at the statewide level has actively opposed this. The Massachusetts Association of Realtors, for example, says it's a tax increase. It increases the cost of buying a house.
I know that you, I think you already spoke with State Senator Julian Cyr earlier this morning. What was the reaction locally to not getting this transfer fee?
Well, certainly people who have supported it are disappointed. I have spoken to Senator Cyr. I've spoken to officials in Provincetown and Nantucket, some of the biggest supporters of this. They're all disappointed. One thing that came up, Christy Farentella, who's the housing director on Nantucket, said perhaps the transfer fee could be revived specifically for seasonal communities as a, you know, one of the functions of this designation going forward. So that's one idea, but it's not in there for now. Senator Cyr says, even though it's not in the bill now, he says it's not dead. He believes supporters are not giving up, and that, you know, that proposal, that policy idea could still have a future.
Let's turn to offshore wind for a minute, because you reported this week on some new action by town officials across our region regarding offshore wind, and this is off the Outer Cape. Tell us what these town officials are doing.
Yeah, this is an interesting moment of like collective action on offshore wind regionally, because this the Cape and Islands Municipal Leaders Association represents 22 communities. And they sent a letter this week to the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management asking for more time to comment and more information about this plan to lease eight different wind areas to developers in the Gulf of Maine. These areas begin 25 miles off the Outer Cape, and the letter asks the government numerous questions about that. This group is also asking for visual simulations of what the lights on the turbines would look like at night. Most likely, those lights would only be on when planes are going by and then turn off, which is what is supposed to be happening with Vineyard Wind, although there's like an automated system that they need to use, which is not operating yet. So for now, as far as I'm aware, within the last day or so, those lights are on at night all the time at Vineyard Wind. And again, that's one of the things the communities want to know about Gulf of Maine wind, which is right off the Outer Cape. What will it look like out there at night when the lights do come on?
One of the officials you've spoke with on this, Doug Brown, was saying that the name itself is a little bit misleading for folks on the Cape. It's called Gulf of Maine. You know, this area that they're looking at, it's in the Gulf of Maine, but it's really a large portion of it is off the Outer Cape. It's closer to the Outer Cape than it is to Maine.
Yes. And he was Doug Brown was is sort of like saying, I have to admit, you know, I didn't realize that right away. But he is not the only person who said that to me. The term Gulf of Maine really does not inspire thoughts that it's going to be right off Cape Cod. So if you look at the map of the Gulf of Maine wind areas, which generally, you know, each wind area is a separate lease and they go to different developers, six of those are closer to Cape Cod than to Maine, and then two, the remaining two out of the eight are farther north. But yes, certainly Doug Brown from Falmouth was not the only person who said to me, oh, we, you know, it seems like people in our communities are really just kind of tuning in now to the fact that this is a Cape issue.
These town officials, they're looking for one of the things they're asking the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management for is nighttime images of what it could look like out there with these wind turbines built about 20, 25 miles off the Outer Cape there. But a rendering of what the turbines could look like in daytime has already been released. Is that right? Talk a little bit about that.
Yes, so BOEM, the agency that handles offshore wind, has produced multiple simulated images looking out from three different vantage points. They are Highland Light in Truro, Marconi Station, and Nauset Beach. So it's not easy to find online, except on our website where we'll have it at some point very, very soon. But They show multiple views looking sort of, if you're standing at Marconi Station and you look to the left, or you look at maybe a 45 degree angle, or you look straight out, what are the different images? They also show what's called the predicted visibility based on the actual atmospheric conditions the day they took the photo, which, could be a little hazy. And then they have other images that show the maximum visibility, which is what the turbines might look like if there were no cloudiness or, any obstruction that day. Also, those images do sh assume a turbine size of 16 to 18 megawatts, because over time, turbines are getting larger, and it's going to take a number of years for these projects to develop. But it does mention that, at least in floating wind, that size turbine is not commercially available yet. So there's a lot of there are a lot of instructions on the BOEM website about how they want you to view these images, what they want you to take into consideration when you look at them. There are quite a few different images to see.
And we should have that up on our website sometime this morning.
Yes.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
Eight critically endangered sea turtles rescued from the shores of Cape Cod this winter made their return back to sea this week. CAI's Eve Zukoff watched their release from a West Dennis beach and joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
Set the scene for us. You went out there early in the morning to watch this happen. What was it like on the beach?
Well, Steve, the beach was full of Mass Audubon volunteers and locals who do the work of saving cold-stunned turtles in the winter. And they were just kind of like grinning and cooing and taking pictures, getting ready to see these eight Kemp's Ridley sea turtles, the most endangered sea turtles in the world, get let back out to sea. They were brought in individually in plastic containers, and they were set down on the beach, kind of lining up all eight containers. It gives the turtles a chance to smell the air, kind of take it all in. And then two turtles were taken out first and walked around so that people could just kind of have a look at them.
How big are they?
They're about the size of a dinner plate,
okay.
A small dinner plate. They're 10 pounds, the smallest sea turtles in the world, actually. They're quite cute, if
okay.
I can say so. And they, it was just really cool, yeah, for people to see these animals and that they had made it through 7 months of rehab at a sea turtle hospital in Quincy. And so then they were set down on the beach where the first two tried to walk into the water, but they had a hard time getting over seaweed mounds. Again, they're really small. So volunteers picked them back up, walked them into the water. And then the turtles were released in groups of two or three. So this happened again and again until all eight, their heads dipped under the water and they were gone. They were headed out into Nantucket Sound.
So these turtles, as we say, were picked up on Cape Beaches in the winter. What did rehab look like for these turtles? They've been at this for, 6 months.
Yeah, well, it's a hospital setting where they're treated for hypothermia, pneumonia, dehydration, blood infections, cuts, fractures. These sea turtles had suffered quite a bit after stranding on these Cape Cod beaches in November and December. Basically, they become unable to regulate their body temperature in the cold waters of Cape Cod Bay. They get stuck around kind of like the hook shape that we have here, and they just wash ashore in quite rough shape. And it's not just these eight Kemp's Ridleys, to be clear. There are among 400 live sea turtles that stranded this winter. I imagine there are loggerheads and leatherbacks and others in there. And thankfully, this Quincy Hospital is where they can get the care they need.
So these turtles that are released, will they stick around? Should we expect to see them in local waters this summer?
That's the hope. Don't touch them, but you should see them. The turtles are being tracked with microchips, same as what's in dogs and cats, actually. So researchers will know if one of them gets turned around and ends up back on a beach. But the vast majority should spend the summer in Cape Cod Bay, where they can eat lots of crabs and mussels and shellfish. And then when it's a bit colder, they will probably head south into the Gulf Stream and then maybe hit Florida, possibly beyond. Of course, this doesn't prevent against future stranding, though. Warming waters because of climate change have increased how many turtles a year are cold stunning. So 20 years ago, volunteers were working with maybe 30 live turtle strandings a year. Now they see an average of 400 a year, and they do expect it'll hit 1,000 in the coming years.
Okay, I want to return to this group that was released this week. Was there a turtle that really made an impression? I guess the staff, they've been living with these turtles for 6 months that you got to see released.
Yeah, and you get to know their personalities is what they told me. Like, some of them are more easygoing. And I was like, what makes an easygoing turtle? And they were like, you can just tell. And I was like, okay. But this batch of turtles, they were amazing. They were all named for flowers. So there was Dragon's Breath, Lady Slipper, Dahlia, Cosmos, Lily Pad, Catmint, and Turtle Head. And the one that really captured hearts and minds was called Electric Daisy. She had suffered some serious lung and blood issues. They thought she was blind for a while. They had specialists come in to test her vision, but eventually they were able to kind of help her along. It was not looking good, but they got her to eat once they separated her from other turtles. And this week, yeah, she was strong enough to head out on her own.
And the New England Aquarium has more sea turtles that are still recovering that they're hoping to release later this summer?
Yes, there are 27 more in the hospital. There's a chance that even like locals will be able to go see that release. They try to keep these things small and calm and organized, so that might not happen. But we will let people know if they do it again.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff. Eve, thank you.
Thank you.
This is the news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Noah Glasgow of the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. This is the news roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. A new generation of lobster fishers is emerging on Martha's Vineyard. Noah Glasgow of the Vineyard Gazette has a profile of four young men entering the fishery, the oldest of them in their early 20s. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Tell us about one of these guys, just to give us a flavor of what we're talking about here.
Well, I'll tell you about the youngest of the four. Tegan Gale just graduated high school a few weeks ago. Last summer, after his junior year of high school, he bought an old fishing boat and lobster permit off his dad, a commercial fisherman. And since then, he now has almost 100 lobster pots in the water with more on the way, and he is pulling lobsters off the Vineyard Sound and slinging them in local seafood markets and restaurants.
You profiled these four young men, and as I say, you start with Tegan, who's the youngest, but they're all in, the oldest is just in their mid-early 20s, I guess. Are they all from fishing families?
They are. All four come from island fishing families. They've spent much of their student lives and early professional lives on fishing boats in and around the island.
And why go into fishing right now? What did they tell you when you asked them this? Obviously, the fishing as an industry is really a tough and challenging place to enter.
Well, I think that fishing has a generational appeal for these young men. I also think that fishing for them is a source of freedom and independence. Many of them told me that they've spent their whole lives on the water and they'd like to be their own boss, make their own living, and strike out on their own without having to work for someone else. So they've each found their own permits and their own boats and are making a go of it independently.
They're making a go of it independently, and yet they seem to be bonded as a group, understanding that each of them are sort of going through this challenge together as a group. How useful does it seem to them to have each other as they're trying to start this career?
Well, I think that like anything, they're each other's competition and they're each other's closest friends. I think that having the resources of close friends in the business with you, it helps them keep an eye on the market. It helps them keep an eye on the water. It's a source of knowledge and of companionship, solidarity as they break into what can be a very difficult industry. Of course, they don't tell each other everything. They still have to make a living. But I think that having each other is a huge part of the draw getting into fishing, and it's what's going to keep them around the harbor.
I'm curious, one of the subtexts of the story here is that there's really a difference in attitude. There's these older generation of fishermen, many of whom are getting out of the business, and then there's this small group of young people who are trying to get into the business. Talk about that little difference in attitude and your perception of it.
Well, I think that for a lot of the older generation, the fishery is on the decline and environmental regulations are on the rise and force a high turnover in gear and equipment. But for the younger generation, the smaller fishery and the high turnover in equipment costs are simply part of the game. So as old people get out, the younger generation sees this as their opportunity to get in. The younger generation is extremely grateful to the older generation of island fishermen. It's very easy for fishermen on the island to sell their permits out to larger seafood ports like New Bedford, but the older generation, even if they're getting out of fishing, wants to see new island kids come up and take over their permits, take over their boats, and keep the local fishing tradition alive, even if they think that their time is over as an older generation.
We've heard some reporting about how the lobster population is in decline in southern areas, kind of like down here around Cape Cod, as opposed to northern and Maine, where it is changing. Climate change is affecting lobsters everywhere. What do they tell you about the lobster population and trying to make a living off of them?
Well, I think all these young men are just getting into the lobstering business. A lot of them told me that although they entered hearing rumors from fellow fishermen and having some knowledge from scientists of the dwindling population, they're still trying to sort that out themselves. I know many of these young fishermen are excited to try lobstering in waters that haven't been lobstered recently, to keep exploring, keep trying new things. They're not set in their ways. They're not set in their particular positions, and they're just looking for a good catch. I think that before they embrace wholeheartedly the story of lobster decline, they're gonna try every resource they have to make a living off the Vineyard Sound.
It was nice. They had some advice for people, which is to buy local. That if you're on the island on the vineyard, ask for Vineyard lobsters.
Yeah, that's right. Many of the even on the Cape and Islands, lobster that's branded as local can come from as far north as Maine or even Atlantic Canada. If you're talking to your fishmonger, you can ask them for Vineyard lobsters. They have the ability to get Vineyard lobsters. They know the fishermen. It's just a money thing. But if the market demands hyper local, then the fish markets will supply.
Along with your profile here, some great photographs from Ray Ewing. Encourage folks to go to the website, Vineyard Gazette, check it out. So it's a really nice picture of the young men in their different boats working out in the water. It's a great profile here from Noah Glasgow of the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
A home along the coast in Chatham is valued at $20 million. It's in danger of falling into the water, and extraordinary efforts are being undertaken to protect it, creating some concern of their own for the town. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us to explain. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Steve.
Just to set the scene here, this property had a significant seawall protecting it, and that got undermined, and it seemed very quickly.
Indeed. The wall was built in 1991 to protect this 7,000-plus square-foot home. It actually runs from the Monomoy Wildlife Refuge headquarters property west to this house. There's four homes in that area, but it's only the section where this home is that where the wall has been undermined significantly. And that's because of the dynamics. You know, we've talked a lot about the dynamics of the shore in Chatham, especially in this area where, you know, the fish and wildlife has lost hundreds of feet of their property. That has sort of cascaded down to this house is sort of at a corner at the end of an upland area, and beyond it is more lower lands, coastal beach instead of, coastal bank. And with the just with the dynamics of the current going through there, it undermined this wall over the last maybe 6-8 months, and basically the wall disappeared, which opened up this property to extensive erosion. And we've had lots of trees, not only from this property, but from the fish and wildlife property, go into the into the channel and into the waterways there, which has caused some significant hazards for boaters.
I want to ask you about the plans. Now, they're working hard to stabilize this bank in front of the house and to kind of rebuild a wall, but the effort is massive. They're talking about 900 truckloads of rock to be delivered, and you think about that kind of construction site in the middle of a town in the middle of summer.
Yeah, there's, as you said, a lot of concern about this, which is kind of an understatement. But originally they wanted to put a steel sheeting bulkhead in, but they found out that the bank wouldn't support it in that area. And so, we're talking about like 200 feet stretch of shoreline here. And so in order to make that protection that they need, they decided they would build the wall, build a more formidable wall there using rocks. And they had proposed something like 900 10-wheel dump trucks full of rocks that would be required. And there was, this came before the Board of Selectmen the other day, and there was a lot of concern for, number one, wear and tear on the roads, especially out near Morris Island. There's a section of Morris Island Road that has an old culvert and tide gate in it, and there's concern that won't support this much heavy traffic. The contractor actually put steel plates over that area, that section of the road, to try to bolster it up. But the original plan was also to take these dump trucks straight through downtown Chatham, which is kind of the direct route. But you can imagine, if you've ever been to downtown Chatham in the summer, it's almost impossible to get a normal vehicle through there.
Much less a giant dump truck full of rocks.
Exactly. Yeah. You'd be basically making the road a one-way street, which is not tenable. So the contractor and the property owner did agree to reroute those trucks away from Main Street, I'm sure, to the relief of many of the shop owners downtown.
And they're also talking about having a barge anchored more or less all the time through the summer just off the shore there, and it's a busy waterway.
It's a busy waterway. It's the chief route between Nantucket Sound and Stage Harbor and the Chatham Harbor in the Atlantic Ocean. The barge would hold a crane that would help position these rocks in place. They originally were planning a big barge. I can't remember the size of it exactly, but it was very, very large. And there was concern by the harbor master that this was going to impede navigation through the channel. So they agreed to use a smaller barge. There's also been work by the harbor master to pull out those trees that we've talked about through there, because he's concerned that they're going to get in the way of the boat traffic down there, and that you're zipping through the channel at high tide, and if you run into a large tree, that's pretty dangerous.
There's a lot more here. It's a complicated undertaking. The town is really moving to try to make sure that this work that happens doesn't leave it on the hook for any damage to roads or other implications for the town. You can read all about it in the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
A Provincetown man charged last year with assaulting a J-1 student with destruction of property and disorderly conduct was found not guilty this spring. But a closer look at the trial shows evidence was withheld from the jury, raising questions about the process here. Sam Pollock of the Provincetown Independent joins us with this. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
The incident at the heart of this case was witnessed by several town employees, but it sounds like their report about it, which was extensive, and a video taken in the aftermath were never presented in court. Tell us what happened.
Right. So essentially, this assault unfolded during a follow-up health inspection in the apartment where four J-1 Bulgarian students were staying after their landlord allegedly shut off their access to water. And during that incident, the town officials, which included the health director, building commissioner, and code enforcement officer, witnessed the landlord, Paul Schofield, who's also an innkeeper in town, assaulting one of the students and also removing their belongings, destroying their possessions in the act. The written statements in the health department records, where they describe what they saw, did not make it to the DA's office and therefore were not turned over as evidence. And neither was a video that Health Director Leslie Roll took of the incident.
So this went to trial in March this year
yes.
at Orleans District Court. And then after the trial was over, you, the independent, took a look at this and realized that this evidence had never made it into court. You reached out to the district attorney and to the police to find out what happened and why this information wasn't presented. What did you hear?
Right. So with regards to the video, which we believed was important evidence, according to town manager Alex Morse and police chief Jim Golden, the officer, responding officer Simon Saliba, took a look at the video after the arrest. It sort of took 5 seconds to determine on his own that the video would not be permissible as evidence, and he could testify to what was in the video. No one else in the police department has seen the video. Neither has town manager Alex Morse or the DA's office.
The students at the heart of this incident, the four Bulgarian students who were here as J-1 workers, they weren't even notified of the trial. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Explain about how that they could have a trial with these people as the victims that were not notified.
Right. So according to the DA's office, the victim witness advocate who is sort of in charge, whose role is to sort of get in contact with these students, they were provided with a local mailing address and their U.S. phone numbers. Their U.S. phone numbers had sort of lapsed after they returned to Bulgaria, and the U.S. mailing address that they had on file was to their landlord or assailant's address. So all sort of correspondences went to the defendant's address and not the victim's. The victims say that they, you know, after the arrest, went to the police station and gave sort of oral statements regarding the incident, and also gave their emails. They gave their phone numbers, and they gave a local PO box of their employer, Dolphin Police. Mm. So they say that the police, there's no way that the police didn't have their contact information, and they just did not give that contact information to the DA's office.
Can I ask you, when you say that they say this, were you able to find them and ask them about this?
Yes, I've been in extensive contact with two of the students.
So yeah. They're not off the grid there. You were able to be in contact with them.
Yeah, it took pretty quick. It wasn't an ordeal to find them.
Okay. What's the takeaway here? What happens, you know, what's the district attorney say about this, and what do we learn about this, or what goes forward?
Yeah, well, so I think the big takeaway for us is, you know, justice wasn't sort of met in this incident. The students were applying for J-1 visas to return to Provincetown this summer. Their visas were denied, and they think it's because of this incident, because, 2 months ago, they were called into the U.S. Embassy in Bulgaria and asked to give written and oral statements about their side of the story. So I think there's a sense that justice wasn't served, and these students are sort of the ones getting punished now because they're, you know, not allowed to come back. Mm.
Sam Pollock of the Provincetown Independent. Sam, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Josh Bowling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. On Nantucket, residents concerned over PFAS chemicals in their private well drinking water are saying the town should be more responsive and proactive. Josh Bowling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror has details here. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
This came up at a recent public forum. The town was laying out what it says has been a strong response. And your paper characterizes this distance between the two positions as a disconnect.
It certainly appears to be, and it did show up at this public forum, public summit on PFAS this week on Tuesday. Members of the public who attended the informational meeting said the town is simply not doing enough. They claim it is not being proactive and dragging its heels on responding to their concerns. They also said the town needs to be more transparent about PFAS testing results and possible hotspots around the island. Assistant Town Manager Greg Tivnan, however, along with representatives from the company that is doing the town's PFAS testing and investigation, said that the town has gone to great lengths to address PFAS since it first came to light as an issue in 2019. Since that time, the town has appropriated $15 million for PFAS-related efforts, Tivnan said, including groundwater sampling and monitoring, wastewater sampling, and the primary project, a water main expansion west of the airport, which brought town water to nearly 80 homes. Those efforts have really put the town ahead of the curve compared to other towns in the state, Tivnan said.
Tell us what the residents here who are taking issue with that, what did they point to?
They say that that all may very well be true, but they you know, there are some residents who said their wells have tested well above the threshold for getting put on town water or for PFAS, and they simply can't get their questions answered by the town or the state. There's been a delay in getting responses. There's been a delay in getting answers. But at the same time, at least one resident, Aisha Khan, who is the co-founder of Nantucket's PFAS Action Group, said that it's more important that the town and the residents work together and really go after the main culprit here, which are the large manufacturing chemical companies that have been manufacturing PFAS, and not not to point fingers at the local level, but attempt to get this issue solved. Select Board Chair Brooke Moore also did say that compared to some other towns, Nantucket is well ahead of the curve, but she did acknowledge that the town could do a better job supporting residents whose private well water has tested high for PFAS.
And one of the other issues that came up at the forum is the landfill perhaps contributing to the PFAS contamination in the groundwater?
It is. It has long been a concern, a question. Testing that actually got started there prior to the COVID-19 pandemic has been sort of inconclusive at best. There are plenty of wells out on the west end of the island, and there is some indication that some of them have tested over the threshold, but not any direct correlation to the landfill. As an aside as well, this is really, at this point anyway, a private well issue. The town's municipal water supply is drawn from a very deep aquifer beneath several layers of bedrock that does not appear to have been infiltrated by PFAS. The majority of the town's wells have had none or almost no PFAS infiltration, and there has been a well or two that has had a slight increase over what the town has been seeing in the other wells, but further testing, it went right back to below the threshold.
Okay, I have to ask you about another story here. The Nantucket Wine Festival has been in the news with a very public dispute. The festival's been going on for almost three decades, and now the owner is accusing a separate group of a kind of takeover, I guess you'd say.
Exactly, a kind of takeover. The Nantucket Wine and Food Festival and its owner, Nancy Bean, have filed a lawsuit in federal court against the Gordon Companies, which is a wine distribution company, its CEO David Gordon, and the White Elephant Hotel, where the bulk of the wine festival's events have been held in recent years, over what Bean alleges is an attempted takeover of her event. The suit alleges that Gordon has engaged in a deceptive public information campaign by announcing that it had purchased and rebranded the long-running Nantucket Wine and Food Festival to a new event called the Nantucket Food and Wine Experience, that it used proprietary information to try and buy her out before announcing its own festival, and attempted to capitalize on the good reputation of her festival. It also claims that Bean and the White Elephant are under contract through the end of this year, and that starting a food and wine festival on the same dates as her festival is a breach of that contract.
How about Gordon and that end of the story? What do they say?
They say that, A, they issued a clarification the day after the announcement about the purchase came out, that it wasn't actually a purchase, but that it was a separate event. They did not immediately get back to us for comment following the filing of the suit, but did say last week that they are in a perfect position to, in their words, execute a world-class food and wine event that will give back to the community in a substantial way.
When would the next one be?
The dates for both of them are set for next May, the same week or five, six days in the middle of next May.
So May 2025. Okay.
Right.
That is Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This week, the state Senate passed a climate bill, and state lawmakers marked 2 years since the Supreme Court overturned the Roe versus Wade decision. Our Morning Edition host Patrick Flannery spoke with our State House correspondent Katie Lannon about those stories and more. Here's their conversation.
Katie, the state Senate has passed its version of a climate bill, and this would allow people to redeem more types of containers, including water bottles, nips, wine bottles. But this isn't final yet, right? Because this is only the Senate version of this climate bill.
That's right. And, you know, there's quite a few different things in this Senate bill. In addition to the bottle recycling piece, there are measures dealing with the siting and permitting of clean energy projects, hoping to make it easier to get those types of projects off the ground. There's language on electric vehicle charging stations and a big update overall on the state's energy grid is really the goal here. Now, the House has said they also want to do an energy or climate bill, but they haven't yet so far, and the formal legislative sessions end on July 31st. And the House has indicated that they're not interested in a sweeping bill. They want to focus just on these siting and permitting issues. So with the clock ticking, it'll be interesting to see what kind of agreement or deal the two sides of the legislature here are able to reach to get something to the governor.
This week was 2 years since the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade. How did state leaders mark the anniversary?
So several top state officials, including the governor, the attorney general, gathered at the statehouse this week as Governor Healey issued an executive order reaffirming that state law here in Massachusetts guarantees the right to abortions, including in emergency circumstances. And this is something that's kind of interesting. An executive order usually takes an action. This really just highlights the existing law. I asked Governor Healey what changes with this, and she acknowledged that the law stays the same, but what she felt was important was to make clear to patients, to providers, to health insurers across Massachusetts, especially in light of other abortion cases moving through the Supreme Court, that this is a protected right in Massachusetts, and including in emergency situations.
Finally, Katie, lawmakers are moving to protect homeowners from the practice known as equity theft. Would you define what that is exactly, and which homeowners out there listening right now should be concerned?
Sure. So this really is a measure that applies to homeowners with unpaid property taxes or tax debts for their city and town here in Massachusetts. If a community is able to foreclose on a home to recover that tax debt, and under current law, they're able to keep the full value of the property beyond just the amount of the debt. Now, United States Supreme Court ruling has found similar state laws unconstitutional, and a court here in Massachusetts has ruled that our own law doesn't pass constitutional muster. So that's something that's inspired lawmakers to step in. The House passed a bill this week that would require the excess equity to be returned in these situations. The Senate has also agreed to budget language targeting home equity theft, trying to stop it through that bill. And again, this is a situation where the two branches are going to need to agree on a single unified approach in a matter of weeks in order to get something over the finish line here.
Plenty to get over the finish line before the end of July. Katie Lannon from the State House, as always, thank you for breaking this down for us.
Thank you.
And that was CAI Morning Edition host Patrick Flannery speaking with our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon. This is the News Roundup. On The Point, I'm Steve Junker. A plume of PFAS-contaminated groundwater is coming from the former Barnstable Fire and Rescue Training Academy. Now, Barnstable County is putting money toward addressing the cleanup. CAI's Gilda Geist has that story and more and joins us. Hi, Gilda.
Hi.
It's a considerable amount of money the county is starting this with. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, so back in January, the county commissioners initially proposed taking $7.8 million from the county's unreserved funds to use for PFAS cleanup near the former Fire Training Academy. That idea eventually went before the assembly. The assembly approved it, and so now the money was able to be transferred to what they're calling the PFAS Stabilization Fund, and that was announced in the county commissioners' meeting last week. The county has been working on this PFAS issue for years. As we know, it's a long and expensive endeavor, and so having the stabilization fund should help move things along. When I spoke to County Administrator Beth Albert earlier this week, she described the county's PFAS cleanup efforts as aggressive. So they're really trying to keep things moving. Currently, they're in phase two of a comprehensive site assessment, which is basically figuring out how far the PFAS contamination has traveled with the groundwater. That's going to help the county evaluate the level of risk PFAS is posing to the environment, to human health. And then they'll be able to decide what remedial actions to take next.
PFAS, this is the so-called forever chemicals. Remind us where this groundwater contamination came from. It's pretty clear where it came from, right?
Yeah. So basically, firefighting foam, aqueous firefighting foam, they call it, contains PFAS. And so for decades, trainees at the Barnstable Fire and Rescue Training Academy were using this firefighting foam, which would basically, over time, soak into the ground and end up polluting the groundwater in the area for years to come. So, you know, like you said, PFAS are sometimes referred to as forever chemicals because of how long they stay in the environment without breaking down. And this quality is actually what makes the firefighting foam work. PFAS are resistant to heat and degradation, making them robust enough to serve as an excellent fire suppressant. The problem is, of course, that in recent years, PFAS have been linked to some pretty serious health problems, like certain cancers and immune system disorders. So the county prohibited the use of this foam in 2009, and it hasn't been used here at all since. But again, these are what we're calling forever chemicals, so there's still a lot of work to be done, hence the stabilization fund.
And this stabilization fund, this $7.8 million that's been put forward here, this is apparently, this is not likely to be all the money required for this cleanup.
Certainly not. So the county administrator, Beth Albert, says the county will be able to put more money in the fund later on if they want, which they probably will. But also, county commissioners recently gave their approval for the county to apply for a loan from the Massachusetts Clean Water Trust, and that's also for PFAS cleanup. So that loan would go toward a groundwater treatment system that would take PFAS out of the water in the area. We don't have a ton of info on that yet because that project is still in the early stages, but Albert said we'll probably know more about what that construction project will look like toward the end of this year.
You also reported this week on the Cape Cod Commission moving ahead on its regional housing strategy, which it unveiled last month. Tell us what they're doing.
Yeah, so the Cape Cod Commission is now working on some of the recommendations that were laid out in that regional housing strategy, which, like you said, they released in May. And that's according to Christy Senatori, the commission's executive director. So one action item, there was a list of recommendations in this plan. One action item that's kind of cool that Christy told me that they are going to begin working on is this concept of pre-approved housing designs. So the idea behind that is that the commission can develop a series of housing plans that are affordable, legal, and fit stylistically with the Cape's existing architecture. So the commission is working with a contractor to draw up these plans. They're looking at all different types of housing, from accessory dwelling units to duplexes. And the hope is that these pre-approved plans will speed up the permitting and construction of affordable housing. Oftentimes, we see affordable housing projects get stuck in planning board, zoning board of appeals. And so even though there are affordable housing projects in progress across the Cape, things just aren't moving fast enough to meet demand. But the pre-approved plans should help move things along. Senatori says developers can use these plans to get a better sense of what's most likely to be approved. And she was emphatic that these plans will be designed with stakeholder input to ensure that the plans fit within the character of Cape Cod.
And the commission's also thinking of new ways to help towns with the acquiring property for affordable housing.
Yeah, so Senatori says her team heard from town staff across the region that it can be slow and challenging for towns to acquire land for affordable housing. So to address this, the Cape Cod Commission is working to establish a regional housing land bank and a community land trust, and these two entities would work together to acquire properties and facilitate the development or redevelopment of those properties for affordable housing. Right now, the commission is working with a contractor to plan exactly how to get that all set up. And the county commissioners are on board with this. So we'll see what the contractors come back with.
That is CAI's Gilda Geist. Gilda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We spoke with Noah Glasgow of the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Sam Pollock of the Provincetown Independent and Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. CAI's Patrick Flannery spoke to our State House correspondent Katie Lannon. And we heard from CAI's Gilda Geist. Big thank you to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. The News Roundup is a busy shipping lane with risks of collision at every turn. He is ever counted upon to steer us safely into port. Thank you, Dan. Thank you for listening. We will be off next week as the fourth falls on a Thursday, so we will talk to you in 2 weeks. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker.